York City. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. Today, the latest on why that nap can add years to your life. And if you're not eating tomatoes or drinking tomato juice, you should. Also, a nut that doesn't get a lot of attention is pecan, or where I come from, pecans. And why should we have more of them? For those of you who want to prevent mesothelioma, antioxidants, an apple a day, it does more than help prevent a cold, a lot more than keeping us just healthy. It actually increases our lifespan. But by how much? I'll share that with you as well. My guest in the second part of today's program will be Medea Benjamin. As you see, we have a packed program. Let's begin. Where I grew up in the South, we were, as children, we were told, whether we liked it or not, more often not, we did not like it, to take a nap. And I remember when I was thinking about this, what it was like to lay there and want to be outside playing, and then looking out the window and seeing everyone else playing, thinking, can I climb out the window and sneak down? Which I tried, and as I'm sneaking down the pipe, the drain pipe, as I go by the kitchen, there's my mom looking at me, and I look at her, and she kind of motions with her finger, go back up, so I shimmy back up the pipe and lay there, but couldn't nap. Today, we need to nap. Science Daily says the following, quote, napping can help with blood pressure management. Quote, a daytime sleep could have cardiovascular benefits, according to new research from a major study at Allegheny College in Pennsylvania. Long work schedules, shift work, increased anxiety, and a greater use of the internet and television late at night, all characteristics of our modern society, have had an impact on nocturnal sleep. We no longer sleep as long as we used to. The average sleep duration is now almost 2 hours shorter per night than 50 years ago, and this could be impacting our long-term health. For example, sleeping less has been linked with an increased risk of hypertension and cardiovascular problems generally. So by taking that nap, you can make a big difference. Now, here's what I do. Because I work very long hours, in the middle of the afternoon, I will shut my door, take a little thing that I can't offer you because I invented it myself. It's not for sale. But it's a little neck piece with magnets in it, and I lie down for about 15 minutes. 15 minutes on that, or just 15 minutes taking a nap, and preferably without a pillow, and on something firm. People have way too soft mattresses. That's why you have sore backs. But something firm, with your head completely down, 15 minutes, you can knock off almost an hour of sleep at night. So one more reason to have that nap. Tomatoes. In Europe, they eat them a lot. In the United States, not so much. And the tomatoes we eat here are most always picked green, so they can all be picked at one time. And then an ethylene gas is blown on them, so they artificially ripen. Why do you think the tomatoes you buy in the stores never have any taste? In fact, I challenge you. I want you to take any tomato from a regular supermarket and take a bite out of it, and then take a bite out of some straw. And you tell me which is the tomato and which is the straw. There. In fact, I'll bet if by accident a tomato got into a baseball game, it could go 9 innings without being bruised. They are the worthless foods for a simple reason. You have to wait until you put your hand under a tomato and you feel it's moist at the bottom and heavy. Then you know that it's been vine ripened. The same way with a peach. When you know that you've got a full color and it's heavy, that's when you know the peach is right. But they are picking peaches immature. Everything's picked immature instead of allowing it to go natural. Something else I'm doing, in fact, I'm doing as an experiment this year, the first of the citrus on my farm, my ranch down in Florida, came out in November. Last year came out the first week of December. I was able to harvest the last of the citrus, grapefruit, orange, and lemon, in September. Now, mind you, that meant that I went 10 months with fruit on the trees, and I never picked anything. Each morning when I was there, I would pick it up off the ground, downers, put it in the refrigerator, and then use it, and it lasts for weeks and weeks once you refrigerate it. If you have fruit on the tree, let it stay on the tree. The longer you let it stay, the better it's going to be. Now, if you should happen to have figs, you throw a simple black netting over the tree. That way the birds won't get to it. Because the first time a bird sees the color change, they know it's ripe and they eat it. And that's why you have to be quick. So anyhow, back to tomatoes. Now, here's the deal with tomatoes. This is from Science Daily from the American Journal of Lifestyle Medicine. Eating more tomatoes and tomato products can make people healthier and decrease the risk of cancer, osteoporosis, and cardiovascular disease. Of all the non-starchy vegetables, actually, they got this wrong. Tomatoes are a fruit, not a vegetable. Americans eat more tomatoes and tomato products than they used to. And the research found that tomatoes are the biggest source of lycopene, an antioxidant that is very powerful. But when you cook the tomato, you make it more bioavailable, meaning the nutrients are better able to get into your body, and that can turn off inflammation. So tomato juice helps turn off inflammation, and that's also true for tomato soup. You can turn off inflammation. And a nice recipe for tomato soup is you cook your tomatoes lightly, and instead of using anything other than about, maybe cover the tomato just to the top and then let the tomato heat for about a half hour. Then the skin comes right off of it. Then you put it into a blender. You puree it. You put it back in there, but now you add some rice milk or almond milk or soy milk. And then add the following seasonings. I cube up a little bit of mushrooms, and I put mushrooms in. Best I have found are white cap mushrooms, but you could also use shiitake. And then sweet onion, and then some cayenne pepper, black pepper, which is pepperine, which is very, very good for your system, very healing anti-inflammatory. And if you want a little of the pink Himalayan sea salt, that's okay, because it's got minerals also in it. And then let that heat for a while, and then finish it off with some fresh basil on top. A delicious soup, very good for you, and fully alive. Nothing dead, everything vibrant. Next up, those pecans. Rich in antioxidants. This is from the Journal of Nutrition. Quote, "Our tests show that eating pecans increases the amount of healthy antioxidants in the body. This protective effect is important in helping to prevent development of various diseases like cancer and heart disease." That was from a Dr. Ella Haddad, professor in the School of Public Health, Loma Linda University. So, what you can do to make it easy is this. When you make your health drink in the morning, and you have all your different, whether it's bananas or berries or powders, and of course, always put your teaspoon of cold organic pressed coconut oil and flaxseed oil, then throw a giant tablespoon of pecan butter in there one day, and then macadamia nut butter a different day, then walnut butter, then pistachio butter, all raw butters, loading the body with antioxidants and nutrients, phytonutrients. Also good for those of you who want to prevent a major type of cancer, malignant cancer. Quote, "Antioxidants can prove a powerful new weapon in the fight against the rare form of cancer, malignant mesothelioma, according to researchers at Thomas Jefferson Hospital and Kimball Cancer Center in Philadelphia. Consumers have long valued antioxidants, which can combat oxidative stress at cellular level." Quote, Fruits such as blueberries, apples, cranberries, strawberries, cherries, and plums are particularly high in antioxidants. Now, researchers at Kimball Cancer Center have linked the antioxidants to being able to reduce oxidative stress, and that can help, quote, the suppression of cancer such as mesothelioma. So that's good. And, of course, I believe that we should have antioxidants in tablet form, because that way we can get a standardized amount every day, throughout the day, five times a day. And then rich in juices, that's our antioxidants. And then in our compounding auric high supplements, that gives you a triple amount of antioxidants, all of which are working naturally in your body. From Elizabeth Walling, 9 reasons to eat more sweet potatoes. Sweet potatoes are good for you, too. They're packed with nutrition. 1 through 9. Sweet potatoes are high in antioxidants, and they're anti-inflammatory. They help with asthma, arthritis, gout. Sweet potatoes are an excellent source of carbohydrates. For those with blood sugar problems, this fibrous root vegetable can help regulate blood sugar and prevent conditions like insulin resistance. Sweet potatoes are healthy for your digestive tract. Sweet potatoes are good for those who are pregnant and trying to conceive because they're high in folate, which is essential for the development of fetal cell and tissue. Packed with important vitamins, eating sweet potatoes boosts your immunity. Sweet potatoes are good for preventing heart disease, high in potassium, and can help prevent the onset of a heart attack or stroke. And potassium also helps maintain fluid and electrolyte balance in the body. Sweet potatoes help alleviate muscle cramps. Sweet potatoes are good for treating stress-related symptoms, and sweet potatoes are ranked 1 in nutrition of all our vegetables by the Center for Science and Public Interest. So, sweet potatoes are good. And want to do something kind of fun? Why don't you caramelize oranges, and then after you've cooked your sweet potato, open it up inside, and then put your caramelized orange inside of that, baste it in so it's completely covered, then sprinkle coconut shreds over that. This is from Common Dream staff. Scientists, as a group, say no to genetically modified crops, yes to a paradigm shift, and I'll quote this. A group of scientists said that ecological farming and a shift towards a holistic paradigm, not genetically engineered food crops, are the answer for India's future agricultural needs. The scientists made their statement in New Delhi at a media briefing organized by the lead petitioner in the public interest litigation seeking a moratorium on genetically modified testing in India. This according to the Times of India. Quote, Professor Hans Herren, the International Assessment of Agricultural Knowledge, Science, and Technology for Development Group, who was awarded the World Food Prize, said, what we really need is a shift in paradigm where a holistic approach drives our interventions in agriculture without reductionist solutions hogging the center stage and taking away precious resources. Professor Jack Heinemann from the School of Biological Sciences, University of Canterbury in Australia, pointed out that the failure of GM crops to address food security, quote, only 2 countries in the world, both in South America, grow GM on more than 40% of their agricultural land, and both are suffering from increased food security insecurity. Most of their poor neighbors that have not adopted GM have improved food security statistics, end quote. And to this point was echoed Dr. Doug Sherman of the Union of Concerned Scientists, who cited his group's study showing that conventional farming outperformed GM farming. The trouble is this was not presented in any of the mainstream American media. A group of highly respected independent scientists saying no to GMO foods. Now, you will recall that I said that in the short term, in all of the 27 European Union countries, including the 17 that share their same common currency, you will not see anything except acceptance of austerity programs, meaning that the people in these countries will take massive cuts in their minimum wage,
their pensions. A lot of people will pay higher prices for regular commodities, and their resources will be privatized. So before, if they received water out of their tap for free, now there'll be a multinational company that will give them a bill. But, I said, within the next 6 months, the people, having felt the actual impact of austerity measures, will rebel. And they will throw these people out of power and take power, and then they will recuse themselves from any more debt repayment to anyone, as did Iceland, and recover their economy and become more sustainable, which Iceland has done that nobody talks about. We're now at the second stage of this. I look for this to play out over the next 5 months. This is from the New York Times. Quote, Spain recoils at its hungry forage trash bins for next meal. From Suzanne Daly, Madrid. Quote, on a recent evening, a hip-looking young woman was sorting through a stack of crates outside of a fruit and vegetable store here in the working-class neighborhood as it shut down for the night. At first glance, she looked as if she might be a store employee. But no, the young woman was looking through the day's trash for her next meal. Already, she had found a dozen aging potatoes she deemed edible and loaded them onto a luggage cart parked nearby. When you don't have enough money, she said, this is what there is. The woman, 33, said that she had once worked at the post office, but that her unemployment benefits had run out, and she was now living on $520 a month. She was squatting with some friends in a building and still had no water and no electricity while collecting, quote, a little of everything from the garbage after stores closed and the streets were dark and quiet. Such survival tactics are becoming increasingly commonplace here, with an unemployment rate over 50% among young people and more households having adults without jobs. So pervasive is the problem of scavenging that one Spanish city has resorted to installing locks on supermarket trash bins as a public health precaution. A report this year by a Catholic charity said that it had fed nearly 1 million hungry Spaniards this year, more than twice the year before. As Spain tries desperately to meet its budget targets, it has been forced to embark on the same path as Greece, introducing one austerity measure after another, cutting jobs, salaries, pensions, and benefits, even as the economy continues to shrink. Most recently, the government raised the value-added tax 3 percentage points to 21% on most goods and 2 percentage points on many food items, making life just that much harder for those on the edge. A little relief is in sight as the country's regional governments, facing their own budget crisis, are chipping away at the range of previously free services, including school lunches for low-income families. For a growing number, the food is garbage, and the garbage bins helps make ends meet. All right? Here's a question for you. How long do you think that young people in particular, who are educated and knowledgeable and connected to the Internet, are going to go out each day and look in garbage cans to find something to eat because their government has given Goldman Sachs and all the major banks of Europe all their money with interest? And all these bailouts, not a penny goes to the people. It all goes to those who know how to control the system, all with the full support of the United States Congress and our business community and the media. Now, here's the issue. If they get angry enough and throw their government out, then they will be looked upon as a dangerous group of people that must be put down. And thank God we don't have angry people in the streets of America, because we'd have then to open the doors of those detainment camps, and we'd have to get our drones flying overhead. We'd have to make sure that Americans are not acting inappropriately and demonstrating their contempt. People in Greece are angry. In Spain, they're angry. Ireland, they're angry. England, they're angry. In fact, in one half of the European Union countries, they're angry because there are no new jobs. But then again, in the United States, the only new jobs are, the vast majority, are low-paying jobs that cannot provide a living wage. And yet, we don't focus upon the real underlying causes of our dilemmas. If we did, then we would have to look squarely at the politicians who receive money from corporate America and the corporatization of everything a power. But I think within the next 6 months, Spain and Greece will both overthrow their countries, governments, and then go off the euro, and that'll cause a cascading effect. Let's see what happens. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. Let's go to our guest standing by now. I gave you her bio earlier, Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the anti-war feminist organization Code Pink. Nice to have you with us today, Medea.
Hey, Gary. Nice to be on with you.
I was reading last evening about, from Politico, Ralph Nader's calling Obama a war criminal and then going through why he is a war criminal in his mind and should be tried as such. And one of the reasons was that, quote, he's gone beyond George Bush and drones. He thinks the world is his plate, that national sovereignties mean nothing. Drones can go anywhere. They can kill anybody that he suspects, and every Tuesday he makes the call on who lives and who dies. Supposed suspects in places like Yemen and Pakistan and Afghanistan, and then in a war crime, he ought to be held accountable. End quote. Quote, Ralph Nader says, Obama, below average because he raised expectation levels. What expectation level did George Bush raise? He's below average because he's above an average in his intellect and his knowledge of legality, which is violating that with abandon. I don't know whether George Bush ever read the Constitution. This man taught the Constitution, and that is what we've got. And he wanted to have a public works program. He really did want to have a jobs program, and the Republicans crushed it, and that is what we have today. So here's what he's saying. He's saying we've got a president who's out of control and doesn't care what the world thinks when it comes to drones. Now, you've done a great deal of work on the subject of drones. Would you go through what we do not know about countries that have told this president and administration, please don't do any drone attacks here, by unanimous decision in their own parliaments, and we, the United States, have said, too bad, we're going to do it anyhow. Take us on this story, please. The forum is yours.
Oh, yes. Well, Gary, it's good you started out with Ralph Nader, because he just put out a petition called Don't Drone Us, Bro, and it's going out to the presidential candidates, asking people to urge them to say they're against killing people here in the United States with drones. And we might chuckle at it, but it's not that funny. Given that we have violated the sovereignty of other nations and also killed Americans overseas, why shouldn't they do it here at home? In terms of your question, Gary, we have been using drones now for over 10 years, since the beginning of the Afghan war, use them extensively in Iraq, and now are violating the sovereignty of Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia by doing it there. And I think Pakistan's particularly important example. Gary, I don't know if you saw the recent report that just came out by Stanford and NYU law schools that look at the number of innocent people killed in drone strikes in Pakistan, how it is violating the sovereignty of that nation, and how it's terrifying the population with this buzzing sound overhead all the time, and people in the northern part of Waziristan not knowing if they're going to wake up in the morning alive or not.
We are not aware of that. Please take us through how many people have been killed. The American media doesn't tell us. Who are the people killed? We're led to believe that only specific targeted terrorists are the aim of these drones. And then tell us about what we have done in defiance of a nation's own sovereignty.
The number of people killed in Pakistan alone is over 3,000. The U.S. government could only name 50 of them. So it has been calculated that less than 2% are any kind of high-level Taliban or al-Qaeda that might pose some kind of threat to the United States. The vast majority are either low-level Taliban who pose no threat to the United States, or they are innocent people. And this is the contrary of what our government is telling us. From counterterrorism chief John Brennan to President Obama, they say that there's only been a handful of innocent people that have been killed. And they really tell the U.S. Public, oh, don't worry about this. We're just getting the bad guys. Well, unfortunately, most Americans are buying it, as the polls show that they support the drone strikes. On the other hand, the majority of people around the world are appalled by these drone strikes. And you can see in a Pew poll that was done, 9 out of 10 people in Egypt, in Greece, in Pakistan, in countries around the world are opposed to the U.S. drone strikes, where 8 out of 10 Americans say it's just fine and dandy to kill terrorist suspects. And, of course, Gary, suspects means somebody who's not been convicted of anything. But 8 out of 10 Americans think it's fine to kill these suspects with our drones.
What about our dealing in drones with Israel and Saudi Arabia, two regimes that do not honor any of the international treaties and therefore are not accountable for how they use their drones?
Israel is number one drone exporter in the world, and after the United States, it's number two user of drones, particularly against the people of Palestine. In fact, when Israel attacked Gaza in 2008, of the 1,400 people killed, over 800 were killed in drones. But Israel is selling these drones all over the world. The U.S. so far is selling them to NATO allies, but there's tremendous pressure to change that by the drone manufacturers. And China is also in the act selling these drones overseas. So there's now over 70 countries that have drones. They say they're surveillance drones, but so are the Predator and Reaper drones that the U.S. uses to kill so many people. They were originally spy drones as well. It's very easy to convert them to weaponized drones.
My final issue is, what about drones over the United States? Now we have them here. They can be weaponized. Police departments want them. Colleges want them. Corporate America wants them. Why should we allow drones that can be as small as an insect, that can actually have audio recording capacity, that could fly right in someone's window? Why should we allow this, since we've had so many other incursions into our constitutional liberties of privacy?
Well, Gary, you're totally right, and we shouldn't allow it. And if we don't do something about it, because of legislation passed by Congress, by the end of September 2012, our airspace will be totally opened up to drones, and we'll have tens and thousands of them flying overhead. Right now, it's still restricted by FAA rules. So as I go around the country on my book tour, Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control, I'm asking people to pass no drone resolutions through their city councils, and also asking them to call their police departments, because, Gary, so far, there's a full of dozen police departments that have gotten permission to use drones experimentally. And the drone manufacturers would love to see every one of the 18,000 police departments in this country have their own drones. So it's important for us to be preemptive and let our city councils, our mayors, and our police departments know that we think these drones are a terrible invasion of our privacy, and they're also not safe because they crash all the time. So for those two reasons, they should be banning drones.
What do you make of the American population's seeming indifference to the Patriot Act, the Homeland Security Act, the National Defense Authorization Act, the detention camps, the lack of habeas corpus, the FISA revision to allow them to retroactively exonerate people who broke the law? And the vast majority of Americans seem utterly indifferent to the corporate state or the military-industrial complex influence upon their lives. Do you think that maybe they want to have their homes opened up for some new virtual reality where there's a camera and a recorder in every part of their lives so that everything is all there all the time? I don't understand why they're not at least somewhat mystified, let alone offended, by anyone's right to assume that they can listen on our conversations, watch our goings and comings, track us when they choose. Your thoughts?
Well, it's like the frog in the boiling water, Gary. They've been taking away our rights a little bit at a time, and most people aren't paying attention to it. But on the positive side, there is a lot of pushback against these drones domestically, and it's coming from left and right circles. I've been working with the conservative Cato Institute. We've written op-ed pieces together. There's congressional resolutions and bills that are introduced by people from the left and the right. There are neocons like Charles Krauthammer saying that if anybody shoots down a plane, a drone hovering over their home, they would be a folk hero. There's a hacker community saying we'll bring down these drones. There's a lot of opposition. In fact, a recent AP story showed a conservative lawmaker in Louisiana saying, even when I go to Walmart, people are pouncing on me about these drones. So we're starting to get the word out, and the reaction has been pretty positive from left, right, and center.
Well, I appreciate the good work you've done, and hopefully people will pay attention and read the book, which is necessary on this topic because it's very well done. Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control, website codepink4peace.com. Media?
It's a .org, Gary.
Oh, it's .org?
.org, and it's just codepink.org.
Medea,
but we also have a website, droneswatch.org.
Okay, we'll keep up on this, and when new information comes in, we'll have you back to keep us informed.
Thank you so much.
All the best on your tour, Medea Benjamin. I'm Gary Knoll. Now, a couple important issues that I want to share with you, and then we'll open the call lines for you to talk back. First, is America the most materialistic society in the world? Well, Economic Clacks blog thinks so. Because when it comes to materialism, has any nation ever surpassed what we're seeing in the United States right now? We define our lives by how much stuff we have. To a large degree, our personal and business relationships are defined by how much money we make, and even most of the important dates on our calendar are about materialism. Just think about it. We throw outrageous birthday parties for our kids or bar mitzvahs, and we shower them with gifts. Most of our holidays have become highly materialistic, and the biggest holiday of all in our society, Christmas, is an absolute orgy of materialism. We make lists of the wealthiest Americans, and we glorify their achievements. Rarely, if ever, do we ask, how did they make their money? Was it negatively impacting the environment or people? We spend most of our time either making money or spending it. Even the phrase, the American dream, reveals how materialistic we are. But when people are asked what the American dream is, they start talking about a house, a car, vacations, retirement, sending your kids to college. The American dream has become all about money and stuff. Sadly, no matter how big our homes are, no matter how many shiny new toys we accumulate, We never seem to be happy. We always want more. And we always seem to be willing to go into more debt to get it. We're the most materialistic society in history of the world, in my opinion. And our endless greed is going to end up swallowing us alive. When it comes to materialism in America, there are outrageous examples all around us. But one of my favorite examples is the rich kids in Instagram. It's a Tumblr blog of photos from Instagram of young Americans showing off how they're enjoying the vast wealth of their parents. This is what the Washington Post describes on their blog. Quote, the controversial new Tumblr is a collection of snapshots from a photo-sharing site that depicts the children of wealth and privilege, summering in the Hamptons, lounging on yachts, and posing by their luxury cars. One does a backflip off a helicopter in near Saint-Tropez. Others snap pictures of their restaurant bills, allegedly paying thousands of dollars for lobster, champagne, and high-end liquor. In the warm Instagram, the youngsters appear to be living over-the-top lifestyles and enjoying every moment. Quote, our every day is better than your best day, reads one caption a bit tauntingly, and do you have a horse in your backyard? Didn't think so, end quote. But just because you have a horse on your property does not make your life better than the rest of ours. Of course not. Wealth does not equal happiness. Unfortunately, however, most Americans have totally bought into this lie. Most Americans believe that more money equals a better life. In response to the rich kids of Instagram, the Huffington Post recently put together a piece entitled The Rich Cats of Instagram that featured photos of cats as they, quote, model upscale accessories, lounge with bottles of champagne, sell on yachts, and ponder life while relaxing on top of piles of money. Well, of course, a lot of those pictures are quite funny, but they also reveal a deep truth about our society. We have spent our lives chasing after the almighty dollar, thinking that it will make us happy. Study after study has shown that we tend to link wealth and happiness. And we shouldn't. But we do. How do we refer to ourselves in this day and age? The American people are called consumers. And the truth is that we consume far more than anyone else on the globe does. Just look at our eating habits. Of all the major industrialized nations, America is the most obese. The next time you go to a store, just take note of how many people are overweight. It has not always been this way. Back in 1962, there were only 13% of Americans who were overweight. But now, overeating is a national sport. At this point, approximately 36% of all Americans are obese, not just overweight. And that's going to rise in the next 10 years to probably 45%. And while we're gorging ourselves with food, what else do we like to do? That's right, we love television. In fact, the average American watches 28 hours every single week. We have completely addicted ourselves. We've trained ourselves to be constantly plugged into something. Our lives have become all about constantly feeding our greed and our selfishness. In fact, that is a major reason for the breakdown of the American family. We tend to view marriage as a temporary condition that can be quickly discarded when it no longer makes us happy. Sadly, the United States has the highest divorce rate in the world by a wide margin. In addition, more Americans than ever are putting off marriage these days. I'm not opposed to that. But I think that if you're going to be single for the right reasons. If you're going to be married, be married for the right reasons. If you're in a relationship, be in a relationship for the right reasons, not based upon insecurity or conditioning. Back in a moment.
In my darkest hour in the world, how happy you have made me. Oh, how happy you have made me. Oh, how happy you have made me. Oh, how happy you
We're having some technical glitches today. Sorry, our computers seem to be in glitch mode. So we're trying here. Let's go over to my other guest who's standing by, Jack Rasmus. Hi, Jack. Nice to have you with us today.
My pleasure. Hello.
Jack, first, in the time we have remaining, which is adequate for what you're going to need to share your insights with us on this, I'm very concerned that the American public are buying into these quantitative easings, that this is all we need. And we've had no major debates on this from progressive economists or people who understand what happens to money when it leaves point A and goes to point B. But this is not the third quantitative easing. This is the fourth, because people are refusing to acknowledge the $16 trillion in secret in 22,000 transactions given to major corporations, hedge funds, banks, and even governments with zero interest and no known collateral. And that wasn't even counted. And that didn't put people back to work, build factories, help rebuild our infrastructure, de-ghettoize America. So why should we believe that either of these parties and the use of the Federal Reserve and quantitative easing and printing money, why should we trust that this is somehow going to be different? It's going to help us and rejuvenate us and start new jobs and make us all better. The forum is yours.
Well, the proof that quantitative easing does not work is the last 3.5 years. The whole idea of quantitative easing, as you say, is to pump free money into the banks. And commercial banks, the regulated, and the what we call the shadow banks, the financial intermediaries, private equity firms like Romney's, right, hedge funds, and so on and so forth. As you correctly point out, since 2009, the Fed has pumped more than $12 trillion. It depends whether you count it to recycled pumping or not, you know, anywhere between $12 to $20 trillion into the banks. And the banks have pretty much sat on that money, only loaned it to hedge funds and equity firms and other speculators, or have sat on it themselves and not loaned to small, medium businesses who need it for investing and creating jobs. The banks are sitting on $1.7 trillion in excess reserves as a result of all this. It's not just quantitative easing, it's the zero interest rates. Banks can go to the Federal Reserve right now and get loans for about 0.1%. Free money, in other words. And then if they want to park the money there before they invest in stocks and junk bonds for a while with the Federal Reserve, park it with the Federal Reserve will pay them interest. So the Federal Reserve, in effect, is for 3.5 years now, is paying banks to take free money. Amazing when you think about it. And, of course, they haven't followed through with the lending except to big multinational corporations and speculators. QE is a variation of this free money. In other words, in the case of QE, the Fed just prints the money and goes out and buys bonds, mortgage bonds and treasuries and so forth from investors. And by the way, buys those bonds at above market rates. In other words, the bonds may be worth less than they are. They're mostly, you know, mortgage bonds, subprimes, and so forth. So they buy it from investors who hold these bonds and subsidize them, the investors, by paying them more than those bonds are worth. And the money gets out there into investors and into the banks. And what do they do with it? Well, according to the theory and the policy claims of the last 3 years, they're supposed to lower mortgage rates and they're supposed to invest and so forth. But three things are happening with all this money being pumped into the system. It's not getting all the way through. It's not getting down to businesses that would create jobs. What the investors, speculators, and bankers are doing, they're buying stocks, they're buying junk bonds, and that's why you see every time we've had one of these four QEs or about to have a QE, the stock market takes off. And when the QE buying is coming to an end, the stock market sags again. And the junk bond markets, you know, same thing. And the derivatives markets, foreign exchange markets, emerging markets, emerging market funds, etc. These are all financial speculative instruments, and the money is all going in that direction, or it's being hoarded Or it's being used to buy back stocks and so forth if it's a, you know, just a regular corporation. So trillions of dollars have been pumped into the financial system to bail them out, and they're not doing what theoretically and what the policymakers say they're supposed to do, turn around and invest it and, you know, stimulate the real economy. That's the big faulty assumption with QE, that if you pump this free money into the banks, subsidize them, that they will turn around and will lend and will stimulate the economy. That's just not happened. They go and they speculate with it because there's quicker, better, higher profits by doing that kind of speculation. The trading desks of the banks, they call them trading desks, but they're just speculators. They're buying bonds and derivatives and foreign exchange and so forth. That's the big problem. And it's not only the banks sitting on $1.7 trillion that we know of. It's probably more. But corporations, non-bank corporations, big corporations, MNCs, multinationals, are sitting on another $2.5 trillion. So there's like $5 trillion just in the U.S. sitting on the sidelines that we've pumped into them, policymakers have pumped into them, and it's not getting out there. It's not getting back to the rest of the economy and really stimulating the economy. It's why we have the worst recovery of all the recessions since 1947. We've had 11 recessions since 47. This is the weakest and most lopsided recovery. Lopsided meaning who's recovered? The wealthiest households, corporate profits up 150%, junk bonds and other bond markets up even more. Corporate profits higher now than they were in 2007 before the crisis began. Corporate profit margins, meaning profits as a percent of operating expense, the highest in 80 years. Wealthiest 10% households, well recovered. How about the rest of us? Well, we still got 23 million unemployed, according to the Labor Department, when you look at the true U6 unemployment rate by the Labor Department. We still have over 12 million people in foreclosure in the last 4 years, and another million estimated this year. We got 15 million still in negative equity. State and local governments are situations getting worse, and they're taking it out on the services and taking out the hides of public workers. So as I point out in my book, Obama's Economy, there are three major areas of the economy that haven't been really addressed, and if you don't address those, you don't get a sustained recovery. And all previous recessions, they've been addressed, but they're not being addressed now. What are they? Jobs. If you can't get jobs going, you're not going to get a recovery. Two, housing. Every recovery has been led by a housing recovery, every prior recession. Housing's in the tank. Housing's bumping along the bottom, two-thirds below what it was. That's a depression in housing. And state and local governments. State and local governments in all previous recessions were hiring into the recession, offsetting the private sector downturn. Today, state and local governments are leading the layoffs. So until you address those three sectors of the economy, you're not going to get a sustained recovery, as I predicted in my book. You're going to bounce along the bottom. You're going to get these little feeble bursts of recovery, that appear like recovery, and they're going to lapse after 6 to 12 months. And we've had three of those so far.
Jack, we're up to the end of our program, and I want to let people know you're listening to Dr. Jack Rasmus, R-A-S-M-U-S, Professor of Political Economics at St. Mary's College in Santa Barbara, Clare University in California. And prior to teaching, he was an economic analyst for several global corporations and an organizer, negotiator, and a business representative for several labor unions. And at one time, he was elected at the National First Vice President of the National Writers Union and is the author of some very important works, including Obama Economy Recovery for the Few from Pluto Press. His website is jackrasmus.com. Just have one, and he is, by the way, starting a brand new program today at 2 p.m. called Alternative Vision, on the Progressive Radio Network. So an hour from now, you'll hear him. Just one last quick thing before we have to go, and I need a short answer. I look carefully at the 36 corporations, factories that are closed every day, over 58,270 in the last 12 years. I look at how many Americans are working two jobs and are underpaid for what they're doing, so they're living off their credit card. I also look at the American labor trying to compete with the Asian labor. They're making 14 cents to a dollar an hour. The Americans can't live on that. And yet we're expected to compete for the manufacture and distribution of goods and services at a level where it's not a level of playing field at all. I see corporate America and the administration and the new very lethal Trans-Pacific partnership exacerbating that. I see, in effect, debt peonage being the new norm in the United States for at least 150 million Americans. So I do not see that we're going to get jobs back because we're not helping the small business people. We're not being innovative and de-ghettoizing in America. We're not putting money into new infrastructure projects. So where exactly are these jobs supposed to come from to turn our economy around and make everything well again? And also, as far as the real estate market, over 5.5 million homes are now in the shadow banking economy. They're not on the market. They're not offered for sale. If they were, the value of people's current homes would plummet another 5 to 12%. So we can't even be honest about the real estate market. Oh, there's a bump up. Yeah, well, bump up. Well, there's 12 million people who've lost their home. 12 million homes have been lost. That's 48 million people. Why don't we pay attention where we put 48 million people no longer have a home? They have to live somewhere. So I don't see us honest in looking at the problem or the solutions through either of these two administrations. Through progressives, yes, but not them. A quick answer to this, please.
Well, I talked about last week when we opened the Alternative Vision show, the programs of Obama and Romney, the similarities and differences. We do into that in great detail. Neither have a solution to the job situation. It's more of the same. Neither have a solution to the housing problem. Both are very much proponents of the Trans-Pacific partnership that will make a free trade zone all across the Pacific, which will cause even the loss of more jobs. I'm going to talk about today on my show some alternative programs, particularly those that exist in my book in the last chapter of Obama's economy, where I talk about that. Alternative Visions is dedicated to talking about alternative solutions, not just causes of the problems. And I'm bringing guests on starting next week to do just that in
Jack, subsequent weeks. I appreciate that. Would you address on your program, we don't have time, we're running out of time, would you address something that concerns me? We are not including including the actual debt that comes when the Federal Reserve loans money.
That's right. That
has to be because we, the American public, are taxed on that. Our tax dollars go to pay for the Federal Reserve's printing of money. Why isn't that considered a part of our debt? If it were, it would suddenly increase by $16 trillion, $3.3 trillion, and an additional $2 trillion, we'd be up to $20 trillion just with the Federal Reserve debt, and we refuse to acknowledge that. Why don't we include corporate debt? Why don't we include school debt and credit card debt? We are not being honest about how much debt we actually have. If we add in underfunded entitlements, funded entitlements, we're over $112 trillion. That means that with $14.3 trillion in gross domestic product, we are 750% debt to our gross domestic product. And even then, that's a lie, because when people are broke and they have to buy something to survive and they're going into debt to buy it, we consider that a growth factor for the gross domestic product statistic without recognizing that as much as 20% of what goes into the gross domestic product is actually creating debt on the other side of accumulating an asset or a service. So where is the magical alchemy to suggest that we are healthy and thriving, that all we need is a little stimulus here or there? I see all this as absolute counterfeit economics. Would you be able to address that at some time, please?
Yes, I will address deficits and debt, and not just government debt, but consumer household debt, and more importantly, bank and business debt, which has increased bank debt far more than even government debt. And that's part of our problem. But, yeah, we'll talk about that on the show today and in future shows where we're going to talk about deficits and debt in whole or part.
One last thing. Would you also look at the fact that we cannot have a surviving market because we don't have ever again in our lifetimes the largest single population was the baby boomers who bought the homes and or took over their parents' homes, and the senior citizens, baby boomers, had the money, had the education, had the standard of living, had the credit to buy these. The new people coming up, the young people, 55% of all college graduates are either underemployed or unemployed, living at home. They are not going to be out there causing a new growth in the real estate market. Therefore, furniture, appliances, roofing, concrete, paint, and all the other things go into a housing boom are dead. Those people are not going to go into debt to buy the so-called American dream. They can't even pay for their college education and are indebted to that. So I don't see a bumpy landing. I see a crash coming. And if we're not paying attention to this, we're in trouble. So where are those jobs coming from? Where's the future coming from? I don't see it. We have so cannibalized ourselves. And the very people that you were saying have all these trillions of dollars sitting in their corporate accounts, banks that have so much cash, they can loan that out since there's really no limitations. Some hedge funds and some equity partnerships have loaned as much as 60 cents on the dollar. They had $1. You know, and they loan 60 times that. You and I can't do this. So if you could address these, we would be very grateful to you.
No, we certainly will. And you know, I guess the concept here that I talk about is the system is increasingly fragile, systemically fragile, and it's addicted to speculative financial investing. And that's one of the big problems.
Too bad that we didn't have more people supporting Ron Paul in closing down the Fed and giving the Treasury the exclusive right to print money at with zero interest, and we would right there have saved $575 billion this year. But that's our loss, and we didn't pay attention when a voice told us something. Jack Rasmus, thank you very much for being on the show. I greatly appreciate it, and congratulations on your new program. I know there are going to be a lot of people listening in.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. We look forward to sharing more tomorrow. And don't forget, 1 hour from now, listen to Dr. Jack Rasmus right here on the Progressive Radio Network with Alternative Vision starting in 1 hour. Have a nice day.